Hello and welcome to Upfront on the Voice of America. My name is Jackson Vunganya. Thank you so much for joining us today. Africa's oral tradition is rooted in centuries of cultural heritage and stands as a testament to the complex and diverse narratives that shape the continent's identity. Storytelling, a central component of this tradition, is a means of transmitting history, values, and wisdom from one generation to the next. Now, beyond entertainment, African stories serve as an educational tool and as a way to impart ethical values to young people while teaching them about the community and its cultural norms. Through these narratives, the younger generation learns about their history while gaining lessons on how to navigate the complexities of life. Most importantly, for African children in the diaspora, it fosters a strong sense of identity and pride in their cultural heritage. And joining me in studio today is Oluyemi Falomo, a retired engineer and storyteller, together with his daughter, Mo Falomo, also in studio. The Falomos are publishers who are on a mission to publish and distribute Oluyemi's debut children's book, The Princess and the God. The Falomos, thank you for joining us. It's good to see you.
Thank you for having us.
All right, so okay, I want to ask you about the story of The Princess and the God. Let me show the book. This is, if we can get a close-up on this. This is your debut book.
Yes.
It's, I guess, your labor of love. You've wanted to publish it for a long time. Tell me about the book. What inspired you to write this book?
The inspiration came from my son. When he was young, eight, nine, it was his favorite pastime is, Daddy, tell me a story. Well, Daddy had stories to tell, but he too had to tell me stories. Mm. So we agreed that he would tell me a story and I would tell him a story. And these were impromptu.
Made-up stories.
Made-up stories, yeah. As we go along. And that's how The Princess and the God happens to be one of those stories.
Oh, okay. And no. that is, was a young brother, older brother?
Older brother.
Older brother. Oh. He's in his 40s now. Yeah.
So he told this story to his classmates in one of these storytelling in the elementary school. Mm-hmm. And his teacher, they were all thrilled, and his teacher told him to encourage me to put it to book. So that's how...
That's why we're here now.
So with the first manuscript came out in 1993.
Oh, wow. But it's over 30 years ago.
But it's been waiting until
this
when
year.
My daughter, Mo, encouraged us.
She pushed you a little bit.
Yes, it pushed me. Mm. It was in a particular circumstance. I was recovering from COVID.
Okay.
And so these unfinished businesses now.
So Mo came and told you, Daddy, there are so many things that you need to do. This one is the one project that you really have to finish. Is that how you got on board?
I won't. Kind of, but not really. So the thing is, he's kind of had this book where he wanted to publish it, but it's like just a manuscript. And for him, one of his things that he's been saying, oh, I really want to do this. When I retire, I'm going to do this. And then at the cusp of retirement was when he was ill with COVID and he was hospitalized for months. So I kind of saw this as an opportunity to get him active and things that we could do together. And that's kind of how the process started. But then I took it on to find the illustrator to make sure that the story appealed to children, his grandkids who are born
in America.
2018, yeah. 20, like kids who are born now, being able to see themselves in the imagery, and also speaking to the times and making sure that the story shows a range of what blackness looks like. The story shows men and women in authority. The story has morphed a little bit, but it still has the essence of kindness and compassion and sacrifice, which was very important for him, and respect. Mm.
And from there, you started a publishing house. It is not just this. Now it has become something bigger than, or larger than the mission is not just to publish the one
book,
The Princess and the God.
That is true. And see, doing research, looking into how can we actually get my dad's book published, we realized that a lot of books that are written by black, about black children. So children's books that are essentially black main characters are oftentimes not written by black authors. And so just looking at the research, I think it was like the Cooperative Book Center in 2020, their research was showing that only 12% of black
children's books
that are bestsellers have main black characters. And of that 12%, only, I think it's about
7%.
Exactly, 7%, 6.7 or something.
By black authors.
By black authors. Yeah. And I feel like that, we want to be the ones to tell our stories. Mm. We want to highlight the beauty of Africa. We want to highlight our culture. We want to show you the moments in our culture that are important to us. We want you to celebrate our culture along with us. But if we're not telling our stories, right, we don't really get that opportunity. And the landscape of how storytelling exists within Africa is changing. We don't have grandparents that we can kind of just hang out with for hours.
Yes.
And listen to their wives' tales and listen to their moments of wisdom. So
and even though you did hang out with them, you'd probably be on your phone watching. You know,
well, you know, right? Now we want our girlfriends on TikTok.
Absolutely. That's another platform, another medium of storytelling.
Another medium.
But, you know, so this book was born out of your father's interaction with your older brother.
Mm-hmm.
What
yes.
kind of stories did your father tell you?
I mean, he told me this story as well. I would say a lot of it, so my dad and I do a lot of math together. And that's something that he's passionate about. But in terms of growing up, the stories that my dad told me were stories that highlighted values, what our morals are, the version that he highlights within himself that he also wants us to emulate. You know, making it important for us to know that it's important to work hard. And when you work hard, there are rewards for hard work. Making sure that we understand the value of like respecting elders within our culture.
Mm.
Making sure that we even speak our language, right? Those are the things that, and education as a whole, those are the values that my father instilled within me. And he used some storytelling, some emulation within just looking at his life and just how he lived his life to actually tell us.
And those are some of the lessons you're going to pass on to his grandkids.
Yeah.
Let's talk about publishing. You cited this interesting statistic, the Cooperative Children's Book Center, again, saying only 12% of U.S. children's books had a black main character.
Mm-hmm.
And this, you know, I guess
best-selling books.
Mm-hmm. It opens you to this new world of publishing.
Yes.
What does it take to, what goes into publishing? What kind of resources do you need to publish a book?
Well, you know, one, I would say that to tell a story is one thing. To tell it well is very important, right? The medium with which you tell the story, the quality of the book in itself, the illustrations, the colors, we want to appeal to children. Mm-hmm. So from the beginning, it was finding an illustrator that was one African, specific to us. She was actually Yoruba, so she understood some of the cultural nuances.
Mm-hmm.
The second part is working and reiterating this book multiple times to get the version that spoke to the level
that
of quality.
That captures the essence of the story.
Yes.
Both visually, right?
Yes, visually, but also the product.
It's such a beautiful book. It's very well written, but also, like, I look at the graphics, the artwork. It's amazing.
Thank you.
So I wanted to ask you, Mr. Oluyemi, growing up in Nigeria, what kind of, who was the storyteller in your family?
My family, storytelling came mostly from grandparents when you go spend time with them, and because we have large families, that is, relatives live with them, so we gather outdoors.
At what time? In the evenings?
The evening, under the moonlight, and there are riddles followed by storytelling.
Is that usually after dinner, before dinner?
After dinner.
Okay. Just a way to relax before bedtime.
Good night, it's not raining, the moon is... so the riddles test your ability to reason things out quickly and get a solution. And then the stories, most of the time, the stories were about inanimate. The turtle, the hare, comparing speed
and strength.
And strength,
yeah.
Or slow, but
Those fables
are mostly what we heard. But in this, I won't say necessarily dispensation, but in telling my children stories, I was looking for things that will really relate, or they can relate to them, or they can relate to. So it's about character, it's about quality, is about determination, it's about trust.
Oluyeme and Mofalomo, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you. Welcome back. This is Upfront on the Voice of America. I'm Jackson Vunganyi. In Nigeria, Africa's largest economy, transportation is more than just a way to get from point A to point B. It's a window into how everyday people are feeling and coping with the economic challenges they face. And one of those people is Samuel Okocha, a journalist who has been documenting his daily commute in Abuja, the nation's capital. He calls it Samuel's Diary, and it's a story of how the removal of fuel subsidies and the rising cost of living have affected the lives of millions of Nigerians. Samuel takes us on a ride through his diary this last week and shows us how transportation is a reflection of the Nigerian economy.
Every day, I use different modes of transportation to get around Abuja, the city where I moved to from Lagos 6 months ago to work as a journalist. I use public buses, taxis, car hire services, and sometimes I borrow a car from my friend here. But no matter what I choose, I always face the same problem, the high cost of fuel. Fuel is the lifeblood of Nigeria's economy. It powers the cars, the generators, the factories, and the farms. But since the government removed the fuel subsidies last year, the price of fuel has skyrocketed from 198 naira per liter to nearly 700 naira per liter. That's more than triple the price in just 1 year, and that has a ripple effect on everything else. For example, this is a public vehicle that I often use to go to work. It's supposed to carry only 4 passengers, but there are 6 of us crammed inside. This is a common practice among commuters who try to share and reduce the financial burden of high transportation costs. But it also means less comfort, less safety, and less dignity. On the other hand, this is Emmanuel Cletus, a driver with a car hire service company in Abuja. He spoke to me while driving me in this Jeep vehicle, which is a more prestigious and comfortable option, but also more expensive.
Before, we used to put fuel for, like, the car I'm driving, we use 30,000, 35,000 to put fuel, but for now, we have to use 80,000 to put fuel for the car. And actually, it's affecting our business, you know? It's affecting our business. And most of the clients, they don't use our cars because the consumption of fuel is too high. So actually this is affecting our business. It's really affecting our business.
And it's not just the transport sector that's feeling the pinch. It's also the farmers, the traders, the consumers, and the workers. Like Madame Rebecca, a fruit seller who farms and sells fruits after work closing hours here in Abuja.
The basket that I buy 10,000, 11,000 in those days, it's 20,000 naira now. So it's affecting everything. And people doesn't even have money. When you bring it, you just be praying to God for people to come and buy. So it's affecting us so seriously.
Madam Rebecca says she has to spend more on fuel to pump water for her crops and to transport the fruit to the market. But she can't raise her prices too much because her customers are also feeling the economic pressure.
There is no gain. I don't have much gain again because of the cost of fuel. The money that I used to save, I can't save it now because of the cost of fuel. And we have to do something. We have to We have to, like, I can't just quit from selling my fruits. What will I be doing if I quit?
Madam Rebecca is one of the many Nigerians who are living on the edge, trying to survive on a daily basis. According to the National Bureau of Statistics, Nigeria's inflation rate hit 29.9% in January, the highest in nearly 28 years. The prices of food, transport, housing, and health have all gone up, while the incomes of most Nigerians remain subdued. The government says the removal of the fuel subsidies was necessary to free up funds for infrastructure and social programs and to attract private investments in the oil sector. But many Nigerians are not convinced, and they are calling for the government to reverse the policy, or at least provide some relief for the masses. For VOA News in Abuja, this is Samuel Okocha, signing off from my diary. Thank you for joining me on this journey, and I hope to see you again soon.
This is Upfront on the Voice of America. I'm Jackson Vunganyi. Moreira Chongwisa is an award-winning Mozambican saxophonist, composer, and producer known for his unique contributions to the world of jazz and contemporary African music. Moreira says that Africa should protect its creative economy by creating policies that protect its content and its content creators from exploitation. He joins me in studio. My brother Moreira, it's good to see you.
Good to see you.
How are
too.
Things in Mozambique?
Things are good.
Yeah.
We have our challenges.
I haven't seen you in it's been a year now.
Almost two years. Yeah.
How have you been since then?
Hustling.
How did the last project go? Like, I remember you had just released a project.
Sounds of Peace.
Sounds of Peace.
Yeah, we won
a very solid piece of work.
Yeah, we won two international awards last year.
Wow. Congratulations.
Thank you. And thanks for the support.
Absolutely. So can you share a little bit about your musical background and how you first got involved in jazz?
Family. How I got involved in jazz was probably because of my father and I would say my parents. Né? And he listened to most of the revolutionary music done by Yuma Sikela, Manu Dibang, Ufela, Miriam Makeba. Of course, we're not with the Mozambican content as well, like bands like Gorwani is in Mozambique. But most of the artists my father listened to were like more saxophone players and wind players, trumpet players. Mm-hmm. And I didn't choose. I think jazz chose me.
They chose you.
I didn't have a choice, yeah.
And how has your heritage, your Mozambican heritage, influenced your approach to jazz music?
I think if you look at the history of jazz with its roots in Africa, me being Mozambican, it's inevitable. So it's there, you know what I mean? Sometimes you could do it consciously or subconsciously, but it's there on you. And the more you grow, the more conscious you become, or the more aware you become about your heritage and your tradition. Mm-hmm. So, and I think this is what is helping me being here today in D.C., talking at Georgetown about the music, my tradition, my heritage. This is what makes me.
You're here in Washington, D.C. You're talking about Georgetown University, where you had a talk recently about your music.
Yeah.
Let's talk about your musical influences, both within the jazz genre and from Mozambique or African music traditions. Who are some of the people that really influence your music?
There's two ways to talk about this. The first way is me not being a musician, just being a young kid listening to music at home. I didn't take the initiative. My father was listening. It was people like Manu Dibang, Fela Kuti, as I say to you, Mozambican bands like Gorwani, Yofuro. So later, when I choose to become an artist, I start having flashbacks of the international music that my father was also listening, not international, but we'll say American music, like Miles Davis, like John Coltrane, Louis Armstrong, etc., etc. So when I decided to pursue the saxophone, I realized that, oh, that crazy guy my dad used to listen to this. Oh, now we used to listen to Brazilian music. We were very strongly influenced by Brazilian music. So that's probably where my skills from being a producer came from. So it's when I look at it today, Jackson, I just respect the process, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
But I was very blessed that it started within the family. The first community is your family.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I was very blessed.
So the things that are exposed to you, the music they exposed to you.
Yes.
I guess you know. So how would you describe Mozambican jazz scene right now? Last saw you, what, 2 years ago?
Yeah.
You had just come up with a new project.
Yeah.
You have toured since then around the country. I know you've been sending me some stuff where you've been going from, you know, different provinces in the country.
Yeah.
How would you describe the jazz movement and how it has evolved over the years, especially in these last 2 years?
Yeah, it's explosive. It's explosive and full of ambition. And more young people. Before, we used to say that jazz is music for old people, it's boring, blah, blah, blah. Now, today, you see young people, they stop you on the road. Hey, my dad just bought me a saxophone, I don't know how to play. Or a father will stop saying, my son likes a saxophone. And I'll go, really? Is it really happening? Yes, but this is the power of the tools we have, telecommunications, social media, the deals, the commercial deals we did with big multinationals where we always show the saxophone. But most important, the positive influence for people to follow, because I come from a generation where if you decided to be a musician or a jazz musician was associated with all the negative things that I don't have to mention.
Mm-hmm.
But today, I think there's a positive influence. I'm here today with you at the Voice of America, a very strong brand in the capital of the world, Washington. So there are kids watching, do you understand?
Mm.
And they'll say, oh, maybe I don't want to be like Moreira. I want to be better.
Yeah.
Do you get what I'm saying?
But and to inspire them to do better.
It's all about Africa exposing its best talents and references to inspire and multiply.
Now, jazz often involves the fusion of different musical styles. How do you navigate blending Mozambican musical elements with the improvisational nature of jazz?
You got to be open-minded. Jazz is no longer a style of music. Jazz is everything. You are jazz.
Mm.
For you to be talking the way you're talking, if you look backwards, where were you born? What were you eating? How you came into this
country?
I have
a little jazz in my DNA.
Of course you've been improvising, you know. Jazz is a way of life.
I love it.
That's why we celebrate International Jazz Day, because true jazz is probably the only genre of music where dialogue, piece, genre are respected. Jazz doesn't have a race no more.
Mm-hmm.
Do you get what I'm saying? Jazz, you cannot say that jazz is played only in Africa or in America. It's played everywhere, everywhere. And it's probably the most efficient vehicle for cultural diplomacy, which will affect decisions that will impact communities with social economic benefits.
Mm-hmm. I wanted to ask you about the kind of emotions though, that you want to convey through your music. But first, can you talk about your choice of instruments and the specific styles within jazz that resonate with you?
I didn't choose this instrument, Jackson. Mm. No, saxophone chose me. I never had a chance to choose. Do you get what I'm saying? My father put me in this beautiful school when I was 7, National School of Music. He wanted to get rid of me in the afternoons, because it was an extracurricular activity. But I went to this school, then I met this beautiful gentleman that we call Professor Orlando, who is the god of jazz of Mozambique. Cutting a long story short, play flute, play clarinet, play saxophone. I wake up, boo, I'm here with you in Washington. So the genres that influenced me and the impact on the saxophone were never thought about. I never thought. I wanted to be an international lawyer. That's what I wanted to do. I want to be a lawyer.
Mm.
I failed. I'm a frustrated lawyer, but anyway.
Inside you, there's a lawyer. Well, I'm glad you gravitated towards jazz.
I wish.
But what role did your government play? Because Mozambique, let's talk about just in general Africa or African parents or African society.
Yeah.
When you think about the arts, it's not something that they push their kids into. They usually want them to be lawyers, engineers.
Yeah.
But your father put you into the musical school at the age of 7.
Yeah, yeah.
This was a resource that was provided by the government.
Yes, yes. Mozambique became independent in 1975. I was born in 77, and I went to school when I was 7, music school, as an extracurricular. So it says a lot about, I don't mean to brag, but it says a lot about a new independent country that was colonized for so many centuries. Do you get what I'm saying?
Mm.
So they created the National School of Music. They created the National School of Arts. They created the National Dance Company. So I'm proud of that government.
Mm.
Did you get what I'm saying?
That's a great legacy.
No, it was a great legacy.
Mm.
So if I'm sitting here with you, and it wasn't private, it was public. Do you get what I'm saying? with teachers prepared to fulfill their duties and to give us tools. I went to Cape Town, the University of Cape Town, without any extra preparation. The preparation that I came, that I had, was from a basic level, not even from a middle level. Mm. But I did my audition. They said, yes, you are ready. I had my challenges with the language, of course, weather, food, homesickness, but technically, I was prepared to get into that. So I think my government, they did a fantastic role. Mm. You know? Yeah.
How do you perceive the audience's response to jazz in Mozambique? Is there a growing appreciation for the genre? We've seen other genres like Afrobeat, other contemporary genres that are kind of taking people's attention away. How is the appreciation of the genre growing, not just in Mozambique, in Africa in general?
I think it's very positive because Afrobeat is a fantastic genre. It's there since it will be there. But it changes formats. There's new nuances that come into Afrobeat. Like today, you're talking about Burna Boy, which is one of the world's biggest stars from Africa, Nigeria in this case. But the great thing, jazz is always there. Do you understand? Mm-hmm. These things, they come, they go, they reinvent themselves. The jazz is there. You've heard about Manu Dibango. He was always there. Mm-hmm. He's not here physically, but the music stays.
R.I.P. Manu Dibango, the great.
Michael Jackson, yes, sampled him. He's there. Yuma Sikela, the same thing. Miriam Makeba, the same thing. So we will always be there. Mm-hmm. Jazz is not great music. No, it's not good music. No, it's relevance.
Relevance. Yeah. It's relevant music.
It's relevance.
Yes.
Yeah.
All right, before we end this, I wanted to ask you kind of advice you would give to young aspiring musicians on how to blend their cultural roots with jazz or other genres. What advice would you offer?
Yeah, the first advice is, of course, you need to practice your craft, okay? And this is not just for jazz musicians, for athletes, etc. But we should make use of technologies to understand ourselves, okay? We should make use of oral information from our grandfathers, our tribes. Why? When you come to the United States, you don't want to play like John Coltrane or like Kenny Garrett. When you say you're from Mozambique, they will want to see on your music, on your sound, your heritage, of course, blended with, okay? So it's important. Then where you want to go with this? Education is key. Because we want to create the multiply effect in order to inspire more youthful. Mm. So education is it. It doesn't matter how great saxophone player you are, how great of a singer, of a football, whatever, soccer. You need to study. Mm. You need to read about your craft. You need to read about your heritage. You need to read about your tradition. Then we will be on the table at the table to decide and choose where we want to be and narrate, conduct, and dictate the narrative that as Africans we want and stop complaining that they are telling us what to do.
How can African governments, authorities, protect African cultural work like yourself, African cultural workers yourself, but also the content that is coming from the continent?
Yeah, I think African governments have to do is very simple, is understand that they only exist because of their heritage. And how do you preserve this heritage? Investing. You got to invest. And the first form and format to invest is education. And if you want to invest on your cultural heritage, which will give you benefits on your social economic decisions, you got to invest on your education. Mm-hmm. And once you invest in your education, it's you, it's not funded, it's you taking the initiative, you'll dictate the narrative. Whatever is written in the books, you've decided. Mm-hmm. What you want to push, this tribe, that tribe, talk about ourselves. You can only talk about yourself if you're in control of yourself. If you're not in control of yourself, they will dictate what you do. And then you'll be on TV just arguing.
That is a powerful ending. Whatever. All right.
Jackson, thank you so much, man.
You're the man. I really appreciate you. Thank you for opening our eyes to these new things.
I'll probably get into trouble.
No trouble. It's good to see you, man.
Good to see you.
We'll come back
again. I need
again
to see you in Mozambique next time.
Absolutely. I'll be there. And that's it for our show. My name is Jackson Vunganyi. Many thanks to our guests that joined us today. Remember to connect connect with us on our social media platforms at VOA Africa. Our website is voaafrica.com. I'm at Upfront Africa. Until next week, goodbye, everyone.